No mai, haere mai. Welcome to the Maxim Institute podcast. My name is Jason, and I'm the Communications Manager at Maxim Institute. Today, we bring you a recording of our recent mic night, Hijacking the School Bus, Ideologies, Curriculum, and Teacher Training. Are you worried about our schools and kids? Do you sense that academic standards are declining, teachers are burning out, and the classroom has become a battleground for ideological conflicts? If so, you're not alone. The data is alarming. More than 40% of students are failing writing and maths in our most recent NCEA testing. Experts predict that these trends will only worsen. We need to take action now. But what? In this fascinating conversation, we'll hear from Dr. Melissa Darby, an award-winning University of Waikato lecturer researching ways to improve literacy, Stephanie Martin, co-author of a recent study examining inadequate teacher training programs, and Marianne Spurtle, a Maxim Institute researcher specializing in education. Together, they'll explore how we can best support teachers in their training, keep politics out of the classroom, and address issues that the headlines are ignoring. We'll also examine the ideologies entrenched in teacher training that have sidelined practical teaching skills. This is a conversation you won't want to miss, so let's join Maxim Institute Executive Director Tim Wilson as he introduces our guests.
Let's get into it. Look, welcome to Hijacking the School Bus, Ideologies, Curriculum and Teacher Training. I think we're here because we're united by a concern for our education system. It is troubled. You may or may not know of a thing called PISA. It's the Program for International Student Assessment. The OECD does it. And here in New Zealand, we had our worst ever results last year. They came out in December 2023. The worst subject, they measure student achievement on an international scale, and we had our worst results ever. The worst subject was maths. And in the reporting of it, it was noted that this decline has started or been noted since about 2009. And that's actually about the time a new curriculum came in, but we're not going to get into that just yet. That's what's known as a tease. Look, it's sad, but in many ways it's alarming because in that PISA study too, the gap between advantaged and disadvantaged students, so students who are doing really well and those who are doing badly, the biggest gap between their reading skills was in New Zealand again. So what we're seeing is a huge disparity between those who are doing well and those who are doing poorly. And there's some more stats here. More than half of the students, and this is Ministry of Education numbers, more than half of the students are not attending school regularly. And if you want more halves, nearly half of secondary schools are having to employ untrained or unqualified teachers. And that's from a PPTA survey. So we've got a lot to talk about tonight. And as I said, we're going to break it into three modules. What's wrong? How might we fix the what's wrong? And what might that look like? And after that, there will be a Q&A. So prepare your curliest questions because the people we have up on the stage can handle it. Let me introduce them. Steph, not Stephanie. Steph Martin has a Master of Teaching, Primary, and a Graduate Diploma in Applied Psychology. She is currently developing new teaching qualifications for the primary teaching sector with the New Zealand Tertiary College. She is also an Adjunct Fellow with the New Zealand Initiative, where she co-authored a report recommending substantial changes to the way primary and secondary teachers are trained in our country. That report was titled Who Teaches the Teachers? Welcome, Steph. Dr. Melissa Darby is a senior lecturer at the University of Waikato. Her research focuses on early literacy skills, particularly how families can help. That's a big part of this picture that's not always spoken about. She has received various awards for her scholarship, including the Fulbright Ngāpe o te Maramatanga Graduate Award and two from the Royal Society of New Zealand Te Aparangi. She is also a board member and expert advisor for several government-funded national projects. Great to have you with us, Melissa. Thank you. And Marianne Spurdle, our own Marianne Spurdle, is a researcher at Maxim. Before joining Maxim in 2023, she had a variety of positions, writing, editing, and designing material for mainstream media and nonprofit organizations. But she holds a Master of Public Policy from the University of Auckland and a BA in Communications from California State University at Fullerton, and is a World Journalism Institute Fellow. And Marianne has submerged herself in education over the past, it's more than a year now, isn't it? Not quite. Well, the fact is that she knows so much, it seems like it's more than a year. But what's impressed me is the passion she has for this subject. So, look, we'll get straight into it. I want to start off talking about what's wrong. Okay, so don't worry, we're going to end on a hopeful note, but we'll start off with what's wrong. And I want to say, or at least refer to the ideologies that dominate teacher training and unions. Melissa, I can already see you nodding and looking into the middle distance. So would you like to take it? What's happening? What effect are they having? And just give us a sense of what's going on out there.
Ideologies, where do we begin? They're permeating absolutely every part of our education system at the moment, to the detriment of the students, obviously, the children that we're aiming to equip as best as possible with skills needed that enable them to flourish throughout their life. The ideologies range from a whole host of things. We've moved from a knowledge-rich education system to a competencies, feelings, feel good, child-centered, child will construct their own knowledge. It doesn't matter where the child is in terms of achievement. It matters that he or she feels good about where they are, even if that is failing abysmally. And we've just heard from Tim that that's, in some instances, over half of the children in the classroom. We've got culturally relative views on things like literacy, and this is something that I've written a lot about because I see the damage that it's doing to children that we're ostensibly aiming to help.
When you say culturally relative, can you unpack that for me?
What I mean is most of us in this room, I imagine, would think reading and writing comes to mind when we hear the term literacy. We are now reading documents saying that literacy includes dance, it includes bridal henna, it includes reading the environment, it includes reading carvings, all in the name, I imagine, of inclusion. But what I see when you look at the role that literacy plays in terms of reading and writing and having really good reading and writing skills, and the skills and opportunities and doors that those sorts of things open, it's not inclusive at all. In fact, taking this culturally relative approach to literacy is closing doors for far too many children. So I could actually talk for the entire evening about the ideologies that that we have going at the moment in our classrooms, but I won't. But they're doing enormous damage. We need to get back to knowledge, back to teaching, back to being clear about what we're meaning when we're trying to equip children with the best education possible.
Mm-hmm. And Steph, when you because you've actually been at the coalface, you've been a teacher. Just tell us how those ideologies play out in the classroom, if you can.
Well, I might try and start somewhere big and go somewhere small, if that's okay. Just picking up on what Melissa was saying, I think a really significant underlying factor here, a question that we need to be asking ourselves, is around knowledge and the nature of knowledge and how knowledge is constructed. Because I think an underpinning issue when we talk about these ideologies is what are our ideas and attitudes about that? And that's where we've seen a significant shift in education over the last 30, 40 years, where knowledge has become, our ideas about knowledge have become that it is something that is socially constructed. And that essentially means that in the classroom, if we take that down to a sort of grassroots level, that means that individual children themselves seek knowledge and they develop knowledge on their own. They construct their own knowledge about the world. And that sort of flips our traditional ideas of education on their head, because rather than the teacher being an expert in the classroom who has something to kind of sort of convey to the student, what it means is that the student themselves, the teacher becomes a facilitator, and the student themselves, it's their responsibility all of a sudden to find that knowledge. And we've seen all sorts of things come from that, including the curriculum, the sort of emptying out of the knowledge itself in the curriculum. There's a significant difference between our 2007 curriculum, which is sort of based in these attitudes, versus the curriculum that came before. And I remember when I was doing teacher training, I came across one of these old, it was a science one actually, an old science curriculum, and it had so much detail of all of the different sort of aspects of science that a teacher could use to help them to teach knowledge. And at the time I was sort of confused, but I didn't really question it so much, because being a student teacher, you sort of think that you're being taught by the experts. But it's really, I think there's a really stark difference there in how we approach knowledge. And I think that that has a lot to do with these sort of culturally relative ideas that also, they haven't helped, have they? They haven't helped these children who are being massively disadvantaged.
No, they haven't. They've made it worse and entrenched the disadvantage that Tim mentioned. The fact is that there is some knowledge, a lot of knowledge, that needs to be explicitly taught. And there is knowledge that every child in this country needs to know. And the fact that we have to say that is a problem, and yet here we are. There is sociocultural knowledge that children will pick up, but there is academic knowledge that children need. You are not going to learn to read by surrounding yourself with books. You are not going to learn about quantum physics by hanging out in a physics department. You need to be explicitly taught these things. And the focus is too much on sociocultural knowledge, too much on child-led learning, too much on children constructing their own knowledge and experience, where teachers are almost dismissed and seen a problem.
That's something that I wanted to ask Marianne about, is the erosion of the standing and mana of teaching by this theory. That seems like a natural conclusion.
Yeah. One of the things that I kept coming across, starting from, just kind of a base level understanding of education, I kept hearing the phrase, teachers aren't valued enough. And so I was asking, what would it look like to be valued, and why aren't they valued enough? And I think some of our conversations around the view of who a teacher is and what they do, if there isn't actual knowledge that they have that they can relay to the students, but instead they're just there to help the student discover what's already inside them, well, you're not going to value that person as much as somebody who holds knowledge, understands how it should be layered, and can connect it to the subjects that those students might actually want to learn more about. So I think that is a big part of it, yeah.
Look, I also want to touch on something that was raised in a conversation we had a few days ago, Melissa, in terms of the some of the distortions around the notion of colonization. And I wonder if there was, you spoke about someone who had spoken to a group of principals. We won't say where, but would you just recount that anecdote? Because I think it really crystallizes some of what we're talking about.
Yeah, it does. And being in education for a bit of time now, I didn't think that there were still things that could shock me. And yet I was shocked by this statement. I had a group of principals contact me because they had received some PLD, where the facilitator of that professional learning and development had said that if they, one of their schools were to show them a successful Māori student, that facilitator would show them a colonized, assimilated Māori student. So the implication, of course, is that, well, very clear message there, is that if a Māori student is doing well and in school, like plenty do, we don't hear that, but plenty do, they have sort of sold themselves out, if you like, to this colonizing system. So that's the sort of stuff that we're up against at the moment in this country, and it just needs to change.
And you're Māori yourself. What's your response to something like that? I mean, does it make your blood boil?
It it makes my blood boil. In the interests of maintaining, you know, dignity and decorum, I won't tell you what I really think. I'll say it politely. It does. It makes my blood boil because of the perception around that our Māori students are then, I guess, viewed through that lens of failure. Some of the documents that come out of the Ministry of Education have labelled Māori priority learners alongside Pacifica and special needs. Now, special needs, children or students with special needs obviously have a very particular situation, but putting that label Māori, Pacific and special needs students as priority learners is the phrase, anticipates struggle rather than success in their academic trajectories, and it insinuates that being Māori is some kind of handicap. Now, when you link some of that to teacher expectations, we know that the research around teacher expectations is clear. The higher the teacher, you know, expects you to do, often the better you do, and the reverse is true. That's reckless, and it's wrong, and it needs to change again.
And to sort of put, and I'm glad that you're emphasising teacher expectations, because at the core of this, and I know there are teachers here with us tonight, and they've come because they're concerned about what we're talking about. In terms of the curriculum, we'll sort of keep moving. I've heard of the fact that teachers don't really get the support they are needing, Mary-Anne, from the current curriculum. I hear anecdotes of teachers downloading lesson plans on a Sunday night from a thing called Twinkle. Can you tell me what's going on there?
There's an excellent study by Dr. Nina Hood about the curriculum that she put out last year. She surveyed a whole lot of teachers on this point, and not being a teacher myself, it was really enlightening to see how the stripped-back curriculum and this attitude towards knowledge puts a real unnecessary burden on teachers, because instead of having the support they need, and then they can, within this framework, customize, localize, you know, adjust it for their students, it's wide open. And that science one that you came across, Steph, I've seen that the current ones are a single A4 piece of paper instead of, you know, 40, 50 or more pages. So,
but here's the crucial question. Are they single or double-spaced, Mary-Anne?
I didn't see it myself, but it sounded like, yes, that the teachers are not getting the support that they used to have from the curriculum, and so they're having to fill in the gaps themselves. So there are several problems with that Nina Hood has summarized really well. But the key ones are the workload on the teachers, the time they're spending doing that is time they don't have doing other things. The percentage of teachers who are spending, I think it's 10%, are spending 9 or more hours a week just getting content for their classes. And then half of them is something like 4+ hours. That's not necessary. But that's the way the curriculum is written because of this ideological understanding of knowledge. The other problem is, now if you've got a good teacher, if you've got a good school, well, principal who supports you well, then things are going to keep carrying on pretty well. And the research is showing that like high decile schools, the lack of curriculum is not really having a detrimental effect. That's very much not true if you've got a teacher, and half of them are not trained in curriculum design because they're teachers. Most of them are not trained in curriculum design, and even if you are and you're not particularly good at that, then your students suffer because that's not a skill that they're trained in or necessarily need to have. But because of the curriculum and the lack of support, it's leaving a lot of students behind.
Thank you, Mary-Anne. And just as we're moving to the next phase, but there's something here too that I want to raise, which is parenting. And Melissa, you have a phrase that, now, for those of you who don't like crudity, I'd put your fingers in your ears now. It's not huge crudity, but it's a mild, it's sort of like a factory floor kind of an expression. Could you tell me what PPP is?
PPP, piss poor parenting. And I had teachers tell me just last week that we have an epidemic of PPP in this country. Now, I'm aware that I'm myself am a parent and we have parents in this room, so I kind of feel a bit nervous saying something like that here. Of course, we have many good parents, as we have many good teachers. But there is a problem with the behavioural challenges a lot of children are coming to school with, and that's something else that teachers have to deal with, which contributes obviously to their burnout and of course affects the other children in the classroom. It's, you know, when you have children, I know examples of children throwing furniture around, and you know, the other 25 children in the class need to leave the room until that child calms down and so on. You don't just come back in and go, right, pick up on page, or, you know, worksheet from Twinkle, question number two, right? I imagine the children are quite distressed by that. So, yeah.
All of these
PPP.
Yep, PPP. There you go. You have it. Look, we're going to pause now on what's wrong. We could go on for a lot longer, but we want to get to how we might help and fix some of these issues. This is the time to talk amongst yourselves. What's your diagnosis? We want to hear from your table. So number one, find the most extroverted of you. Number two, tell them that they're going to be shouting it out back to us, because we all want to hear this. But what's your diagnosis of what's wrong with the education system at the moment? Talk amongst yourselves, argue, dispute, and we'll look forward to hearing from you in 5 minutes. Thank you. Hello. The discussions must cease. Yes, very good. Thank you for that. Thank you, thank you. Look, can we, have you settled on anything? Let's do a classroom situation. Can we have some hands up? Have we settled on something that we haven't been talking about that you've identified at your table that is important? Speak now or forever hold your peace. What's that? Okay, yep.
I don't think that we identified anything particularly new and different from what we've heard. We did put quite a lot of emphasis on parenting again. The notion that it's very difficult to interfere with any one part of a system to improve things when it is, when everything is interacting with everything else. I guess where I might slightly disagree with the other two is that I do think that there is one thing, and it is this culturally relative postmodern ideology, which is, I think, part of the problem. So a lot of this idea of there being different knowledges that kids are going to construct comes from an idea that comes from French literary criticism, which is that there is no absolute truth about anything. And that, I think, there's been what somebody's called the long march through the institutions, and that has been captured in universities, and universities are now teaching this to their kids. I'm a professor at Auckland myself, and deeply concerned about this. Shut up, Douglas.
No, thank you, Douglas. Thank you. And I'm just so offended that you suggest there's such a thing as objective truth. How dare you trample on my identity like that? Look, this is, and what I really appreciate is the look of intensity on the faces that I'm seeing amongst you. This is, we're able to laugh at times, but it's sort of like a nervous laughter. So what's the cure? Yes? Okay. Thank you very much. Well, we will probably continue to contest that, and we may continue to disagree agreeably, but I appreciate you standing up. Let's move to, and I think too, what I'm hearing both from people within the education sector and up here is real concern for teachers that they're caught in the middle of a whole collection of requirements, necessities, administration, etc. So it's a difficult job. There's no question about that. Look, let's talk a bit about teacher training, because I guess the question is, teachers need to be equipped well to deliver education that will stick in kids' heads. What can we do about teacher training to ensure that they have the right skills in the classroom to do that? Marianne.
I thought you were going to go to Steph because she's part of the solution here. One of the stories that stood out to me was I wrote a piece on teacher training last year, and as I was finishing it up, came across a story out of Australia. The director of a bunch of schools there that had 1,500 teachers saw what was lacking in initial teacher education, especially around teaching teachers how the mind works, how memory and learning works. And psychology, especially over the last few decades, has come a long way in understanding how short-term memory and long-term memory and working memory function, and that can really inform how you teach a classroom. So what he did was he sent all 1,500 of his teachers who were experienced and trained back to get further training in those areas in classroom management. And before he did that, 42% of his students were underperforming in reading. 3 years later, which included retraining the teachers, 4% were underperforming. So equipping teachers to know how to teach well is not happening in all of our teacher institutions. And Steph is a bit of an expert on this because you've actually audited what they're being taught. But it's not happening. They could be equipped better. And those that are do teach better.
So, Steph, how could they be equipped better?
I think there's two key facets that come to mind. I mean, again, the backdrop is this kind of idea of knowledge that we have, so that's really integral to all of it. But the two things that really come to mind, first of all, are being more equipped to deal with the realities of the classroom as they actually exist. So there's a lot of talking about different kinds of theories that go on in our university-based system, but when they're getting into the classroom, there are an enormous proportion of student teachers who are moving into becoming beginning teachers not knowing actually how to handle the realities. So like I talked to a beginning teacher last week who said to me, marking writing books. I've never marked a writing book before. You know, so that, and it's bread and butter stuff for teachers, but they're just not being taught how to actually do those things through the training that they're doing. They need more time in classroom. They need more time learning about behavior management strategies, how to get a really calm working environment happening in a classroom. That practical stuff, the really practical bread and butter stuff. The other aspect is what Marianne was just talking about, which is insights from the science of learning, that we've really collected an amazing sort of set of knowledge of the science of learning over the last 30 or 40 years. There's a lot that we know about it that we're just not utilising in teacher training at all. So part of the report that Tim mentioned in the very generous introduction was we went through, my wonderful colleague Michael and I went through all of the university-based courses of the teacher training options that are available in New Zealand at the moment, and we looked at the science of learning and how many of them actually contain that content versus other things. And we found that the science of learning, we looked at 222 courses and two of them made mention of the science of learning. So it's less than half of 1% of the papers available in our teacher training at the moment through the university-based system are teaching the science of learning. And we didn't expect it to, you know, we had a hunch that it wasn't what it should be, but it was quite shocking to actually see those numbers of how it's almost completely absent. So that's the other strand.
And also, we talk about classroom management. Melissa, you mentioned something during the break about the number of kids who come into a classroom in a particular situation. Do you want to just unpack that? So this is what we need. This is the situation, and how would we go some way to ameliorating that?
Last week, I had a school, a secondary school, contact me and say that from their starting this year, year nine cohort of children, over 50% came with a diagnosis. This was at quite a run-of-the-mill school, neither high decile nor low decile, and quite a standard part of New Zealand in terms of, you know, regular kind of suburb and so on. Now, that's a problem. I teach into some of the initial teacher education program. And I have my students complaining to me last year, a group of them, that they, in their entire degree, they had one behaviour paper, one paper in their degree on how to handle behaviour. Now, Steph and I were having a conversation a few weeks ago that you have a finite number of points in a degree, right? And you have to work out how to best spend those points to get the best trained teachers possible. Now, we have in some of our institutions, teacher trainees doing papers on neoliberalism in New Zealand education. Now, of course, you can imagine they get one version of what neoliberalism is, right? It's not a balanced viewpoint at all. They obviously do a lot of treaty papers and te reo Māori. And now I'm not for a second saying that those things aren't valuable. Like what I am saying, how do we best spend those points to get the best trained teachers possible?
Thank you, Melissa. Let's keep moving to the curriculum. So we've highlighted some issues with the curriculum. We've had some good discussion about the curriculum. What should we do to ensure that teachers are in a position where they're not downloading lesson plans of Twinkle on a Sunday night?
There's actually, in Nina Hood's study, she actually surveys teachers and they feedback where they get content from, and social media is on par with content from the Ministry of Education as far as amount used.
Then I won't use that point again. This is the note here is sort of like an after dinner conversation, so there may be sort of tent poles stuck in the ground that you'll say, "Oh, that's a bit contentious." So I won't do that again. But in terms of what we're doing with the curriculum, I think the assertion we're making is that teachers are not adequately supported by the curriculum as it currently exists. Let's go to focus on the teachers and the students. What should we do, Steph?
Small question.
Question.
I do understand the points that both of you have been making, and I don't think any of us intend to be coming across as though we're not on teachers' side. We're actually very much on teachers' side. And I understand the realities of what you're saying. My last day in the classroom was last week, so I do understand. I'm not disconnected. But by having a curriculum that doesn't have that support, where we're really coming from is that we want to support teachers, right, to not have to, a phrase that gets thrown out quite a lot is to reinvent the wheel. There's a lot of teachers who are working really hard to do the same set of work that, if we were to support them better through a more knowledge-rich curriculum, they might have the time and the capacity. And I have a huge amount of compassion for those teachers who are doing that, because they're really, the sacrifices involved in doing that personally are enormous, right? They're giving up their weekends, they're giving up their evenings, relationships around them are often being damaged by the kinds of work that they're putting into what they're doing. So we're on teachers' side, right, when we're saying this. But they need to be supported, and the way to do that, as far as I can tell, is by having a knowledge-rich curriculum that actually gives them that support for the kinds of knowledge that are universal, right? Like maths, the way that mathematic knowledge is built, we might go about that differently in a lesson plan sense, but in the sense of how mathematics knowledge is constructed, that's the same for all of us. Right, times tables are times tables, no matter where you are or who you are. So there are aspects that we could be honing in on there to try and make things just easier for everyone, utilising that knowledge of science of learning that we have and people have worked very hard to gain.
I want you to hold that question, because we'll stick with the format. There will be Q&A afterwards. So appreciate that very much. But as Steph goes, how much time do I have? We don't have time at the moment, but we'll get to it. And so please hold that. And thank you for the contribution. Melissa, is there anything you want to add to what we're saying?
Really just to, at the moment, there are, as I think I mentioned at the start, there are many good teachers in this country. There are many good parents in this country. There are many children who do well in our education system. One of the issues is that at the moment too much is left to chance. In this country, there are children who change schools sometimes up to 5 times a year with very little consistency between schools. Now, we're not for a second wanting to create a sort of robotic approach to education where every single school is the same. That's not going to work. But what we do want to do is to ensure that teachers are clear on what needs to be taught. Like I said, there is knowledge that every child needs to know. And if we care about things like social justice and people flourishing in their lives, then we are going to be clear about the knowledge that is going to contribute to that. How teachers teach is up to the art. That's the art of teaching, the craft of teaching, and that's where teacher personality and perhaps the community that they're in and so on can come shining through. But we need to be clear that we have, like I say, knowledge that children need to be taught, and that comes from a clear curriculum that is knowledge-focused, not competency-focused, not socio-cultural knowledge, inclusive of that, but very clear on what academic knowledge needs to be taught, explicitly taught.
Thank you, Melissa. Look, we're at the end of this, and as I say, there will be a Q&A once we've reached the terminus of the structured part of the evening. So we're going to pause for 5 minutes. Table question. Table question is, what big change would you make to the education system to make it better? What would you do? So talk amongst yourselves. Again, debate, discuss, and we will be back to you in 5 minutes. Thank you. And we're back. Thank you. Do we have any shattering ideas about how to fix our education system or to make it just perform better? We've heard from some people. I'd like to hear from some others. Any other tables come up with anything? The nominated extrovert? Anyone? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so we discussed, I guess, the inquiry, so that was one of the conversations that we had. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Just if you didn't hear that maybe the balance has gone a little bit far to inquiry-based learning, and if you don't have the skills or the information to answer something, it's a question of tilting the balance back. It may be a balance issue that we're just debating here. Thank you very much. So things that will work, success stories, and perhaps we'll be looking overseas here because what we're talking about is a bit of a U-turn. Marianne, you were talking earlier during the break about overseas, how things have turned around, and as well in Canberra. What are some of the success stories that can encourage and inspire us in this area?
I don't think we can point to an education system somewhere that's doing amazingly well, that, you know, everything's going exactly as it should. But the story of New Zealand's journey onto, you know, into student-centered learning, inquiry-based learning, we're a little bit behind other countries. And so France went there in the 1990s with their curriculum, and about 15 years ago, did 15 years after that, did a U-turn. The UK did a U-turn over 10 years ago. So other countries have gone down the same track and then discovered, because the research shows that the more content-rich your curriculum, it corresponds with better student outcomes, which isn't a shock. They've noticed that, they've changed their curriculum. I've seen teachers praising the Australian curriculum. They've gone to a more content-rich model. And our curriculum is under review, and now there's a new government in charge of the review of that. So it is going to look different. We don't know how different it's going to look, but if we follow the good international trends, it will change quite a lot.
Okay. Melissa, tell me about what you're seeing and what, I guess, where you can think, well, there's a glimmer of hope here. What is encouraging you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
What gets me out of bed? That's a good
Apart
question.
Apart from your kids.
I mean, as I keep saying, there are a lot of schools and teachers and children who are doing very well. And I think that we need to put some caveats around some of the, I guess, emphasis that we're placing on changing the education system will solve everything. Because, of course, like I mentioned with the PPP epidemic, there are other factors in the mix as well. I really enjoy working with families because, as Tim mentioned at the start of this conversation, families are often the forgotten player in the mix. But a lot of families really want to support their children's education and learning. And I think that building schools where they have really strong partnerships with families, the children, you know, if the home and school life, if you like, are on the same page, then things can, everything comes together nicely for children. So I'd love to, I've seen really good examples of families in engaging with school and vice versa. And I think that the more that we turn to families as part of the solution rather than always as part of the problem, notwithstanding the epidemic, we may get some really good change coming through.
So how do you connect families to schools?
I think a lot of that comes down to leadership. I think that's actually something we possibly haven't really mentioned here this evening, around good leadership in schools and the huge difference that that can make. I know schools where leadership has taken a real focus on engaging families, providing small events, opportunities for families to come in during school time and see what happens during a maths lesson, what happens during reading. You know, this is what your child's been doing during the day at school, and enabling those conversations at home with children about what's happening, just creating a little bit more transparency. So many parents say to me, I actually don't know what my child does from 9 to 3, and actually the vast majority say that. So I think there's a real opportunity there to open that those conversations up. I also think that families need to be encouraged to know the difference they can make in their child's learning. A lot of families that I've worked with, and it's well into the hundreds now, have said to me, I'm not a teacher, what can I do? Mm. Or, alarmingly, that's not my job. So, PPP. So... I think that we can put out some really cool things. I'd love to see some of them come through the ministry, you know, encouraging families and showing what small things they can do in the home environment to make a real difference to their children's learning.
Steph, I'm not a teacher. What can I do? I'm a parent. What can I do for my kids? Or should I punt it back to Melissa?
I'm not sure that this is the greatest answer, but it's just what comes to mind straight away when you say that, which is sort of where I was going to veer. Anyway, inspiring curiosity. I think that's really something, asking questions, reading books, wondering about the world, you know. I think that's really what comes to mind. I might try and just weave in what I wanted to say to that question. The thing that comes along, I think, with talking about having a more sort of... knowledge-based approach to teaching is that the real joy in teaching for me, I think, is that kind of that spark. And it's funny, it used to be talked about quite a lot, and I don't really hear it talked about anymore, is when kids really actually connect with something, when they learn something they didn't know before, it's so exciting for them. And that teachers can give that to them, but parents can give it to them as well, you know? Those moments of like, wow, I didn't know about that. Wow, I didn't know that before. And that's the thing that actually as a teacher really like fills you up. And I think that's something that we could really go back to, and our kids would really benefit from that across the board, and everyone being involved in doing that. I suppose the sort of community approach to that, everyone can do that, everyone can contribute that to a kid's world, right? So just inspiring that curiosity.
And a crucial thing, ensuring children actually go to school.
Yes.
Attendance.
Where are you at? And let's we're going to broaden out now and hit the Q&A. So by all means, the number is 021-089-19846. Text in your questions. Where are you at with finding parents who don't send kids to schools?
I'm not entirely sure that's the best approach. I'm not saying it isn't. It shouldn't be something we consider, but what I'd love to see is a societal shift in attitude to education, where children are taught to that education is important for these reasons, of all your doors and opportunities that will obviously open up, where children are given opportunities in the early years prior to even starting school to learn how to learn, opportunities to sit still for 5 minutes and then 10 minutes and then 20 minutes and so on, so that when they're in the classroom, they're able to sit still and learn. Opportunities for teaching them to respect the teacher, you know, don't throw things at the teacher. So I think that I would love to see sort of education more so, but in saying that, it's not only parents who perhaps haven't typically had good experiences with education who don't send their children to school. I know plenty of families who go, it's cheaper for me to go to Fiji, not in the school holidays, and therefore take their children out of school for 10 days. And unfortunately, when it's in the media that kids aren't learning anything anyway and so on, that becomes a real problem too. So I'm undecided is the answer. That's the long answer. Sorry.
You sound like you have a career as a politician awaiting you. Well played, Melissa. Thank you. The questions are coming in. Thank you very much. First question, if ideologies are a root cause of challenges in the system, who or what institution is promoting these ideologies and why? Don't rush in.
That's a good question.
It's called biting the hand that feeds you in my case.
Okay. Why don't you answer, Steph?
Well, I'm not really, to be honest, it's sort of this like invisible cloud, isn't it? I'm not sure that we really know.
It's not one.
Exactly, it's not one. You can't, and that's part of the challenge of this, is that it's sort of, there's tentacles sort of everywhere, aren't there? So there's not one institution that you can look at and say, oh, if we just change that up. But I think the ideologies that we've sort of been alluding to tonight are through everything. They're through everywhere. So
I will be brave and add to that. I don't think that we should underestimate the extent to which universities are heavily ideologically driven, particularly in humanities and social science departments. And I think that there is a problem with research in universities where it's very heavily biased in particular directions, that then becomes research gets a bit of a gold standard on it. It then filters into policy. What goes on in universities does not stay in universities. It filters out into policy and into practice. And I think that we need to take a closer look at some of that.
Can I actually just build on that a little bit?
Sure.
Tiny bit. It's just the issues there around free speech. Because I think there are a lot of people within these institutions who actually have different ideas about things, but they're not operating in a climate in which they think they can be honest about them. So a study was done of universities in the US last year around free speech and faculties, and actually the one that came out as having the most people on staff who were unwilling to voice their opinions because they didn't feel safe to in their workspace was education. So education seems to be the space that in which speech is being suppressed the most heavily. So I think that's something to factor into this as well.
Thank you. Marianne, would you like to add anything?
While you guys were talking, I was just thinking about the places that I've come across where it is being done well. And you visited the New Zealand Graduate School of Education in Christchurch. There are places that are very much focused on evidence-based instruction. And I don't know if that's growing or not. I've not been aware of the scene long enough to know there's a trend, that there are people who are within those institutions and in non-university settings who are paying attention to the evidence. And I think the contrast between the outcomes speaks for itself.
Thank you. Next question. We've seen substantial changes in NCEA curriculum with a huge drop in results. What were the driving factors for the changes over the last 6 years? Can any of these be reversed?
I probably can't comment on that. I've focused more in the early years of education, but perhaps I'm not sure if
I'm just struggling with that one as well.
Okay.
Can you read the? Sorry.
Yeah. I'll do it again. And we are going to get to your question too as well. So do you want to repeat it, or we'll repeat it later? Yeah. We'll go with this one. But what we have at the moment, whoops, got to do my thumbprint. We've seen substantial changes in NCA curriculum with a huge drop in results. What were the driving factors for the changes over the last 6 years? Can any of these be reversed? Is this an accurate assessment of what's happened? Yep.
And that certainly, it's reflected in the data that we've got, for sure. These problems don't exist in isolation, right? So anything that's going on, so like a lot of the issues that we've been talking about this evening, well, I guess we've been steering more towards the sort of primary sort of end of things because that's where we tend to sit. But they run through everything. So there's a number of secondary school teachers who I've spoken to in the last year who are having kids turning up in year nine without basic literacy and mathematics skills, which then mean that there's more pressure on those subject content teachers to be teaching those basics. And it's very difficult, right? It's very difficult to be teaching biology as a subject when the students that you're working with are still struggling to sort of form complex sentences. And that is the reality for a lot of secondary teachers that they're facing now. So I think a lot of these issues kind of start back further, but also there are issues with NCA itself as well.
I think as well that when it's very hard to accelerate learning. So if a child falls behind each year, that compounds. And then other things start to kick in, like teacher expectations, for example, like their own sense of self as a learner, if you like, and their own belief in themselves and their ability to learn, self-efficacy, motivation, and so on. So it sort of starts to snowball, and I think that by the time they then maybe get to NCA, it's a bit of a problem.
Some other things have just kicked in as well.
Brief.
Okay. Another real issue of NCA is that it's disaggregated knowledge. So we've been talking earlier about knowledge as being sort of a set of ideas, and it's broken it apart into tiny little pieces, and we've sort of focused on it being on knowledge being very disarticulated, and connections have not been being made within and across subject areas. And so I think that's another key detriment. There are others, but I'll stop.
Thank you, Steph. Now, let's get back to your question, if you could repeat it, please. Would you like the microphone, actually, here? Is it going to reach? That's the question. Here we go.
My background's in secondary, and so I don't know what it looks like in the primary sector. So what does, you were making statements about maths and teaching maths, so what does maths look like to you in your classroom? What has been your experience of how you've taught maths at primary, and what are you seeing happening at your school that you're finding problematic with teaching maths?
Thank you.
I will just say that the issues that I'm talking about and most of the statements that I've made tonight aren't specifically about the school that I'm working in. I work very much across kind of the sector, so it's my opinions are sort of informed quite globally. But I think in the maths area, we took on, some time ago, we realised that our mathematics results weren't going in the direction that they should. And we developed something called the Numeracy Project to try to address that problem. And what the Numeracy Project has done is taken that sort of inquiry-based model that Ant was talking about before, taken that sort of approach to mathematics knowledge so that it's a problem-solving approach, essentially, towards mathematics. And to be honest, I worked within it for a very long time, not really knowing that it wasn't really the right way to be doing things, and I've sort of had to change the direction that I've been taking, and I've been trying to look into this quite a lot as to how we might do it better. But the one thing I will just say is that it's taken an approach whereby we have multiple different strategies that children are expected to be able to master and to demonstrate before we'll move them on to sort of the next stage of mathematics knowledge, where they don't necessarily need to know all of those strategies. I mean, mathematics itself is about finding solutions to problems efficiently, and that we've sort of undermined that principle of mathematics itself and the way that we've been approaching things. So it needs a dramatic turn. Yeah.
So are you saying, from what I'm hearing, that you would have preferred to have been taught one method and one way that would have worked for you?
I'm saying that I think that mathematics itself has a hierarchy of knowledge, and to be honest, I'm trying to work out at the moment what that hierarchy of knowledge is. I can't fill in the sort of details of that for you right now because it's something that I'm trying to work out at the moment. But I think that the approach, like I can think, for example, of a time when algorithms is something that we have decided isn't a good approach out of the that's something that got decided through the numeracy project kind of scheme. And so we've done away with it, and it's something that comes in at a much later stage of mathematics teaching. Algorithms are a fantastic strategy, especially to support with place value knowledge, and something that we're seeing just very, very commonly is dips in place value understanding, and that's interesting to put in light of the algorithms issue. The decision to get rid of algorithms was based on a single study that was done on less than 100 children at one site, I think, in the United States. So we've made decisions based on pretty thin threads of knowledge, and I think that we need to be looking much more closely and talking much more with actual mathematicians who can fill in those gaps that I can't fill in to work out what that hierarchy and structure of mathematics knowledge is. Because what I'm seeing at the moment is children being given enormous problems to solve and sort of thrown in the deep end. And the effects that I'm seeing on self-efficacy, again, not in the specific context that I'm working, but across the board, the dips that I'm seeing in self-efficacy are really troubling. And when kids aren't experiencing success in these ways and they're being thrown into these questions that they just don't have a way into, it's really affecting their sense of self, and I find that troubling.
Just to, I think, widen it a bit, but still stay on that, and thank you very much. One question here, what should be the content of the content-rich curriculum? This is a bit the discussion I think that we're having. What specifically is the knowledge that kids should have? Is it, quote, great literature, for example, the Western canon, or something else? What would be the content of content-rich curriculum? You're nodding, Melissa.
Well, for example, I mean, I don't think that there should be a set, if whoever mentioned the Western canon, for example, or English canon, that there should be a set of prescribed texts that every single child in this country needs to learn, and only that. I think that, like I said earlier, there needs to be flexibility for schools to choose texts, for example, that work for them. But I also think that teachers shouldn't have complete autonomy over what they teach. They have never had complete autonomy over what they teach. Things like the way that reading is taught, the way that writing is taught, we need to be clear about methods and approaches to that work for the greatest number of children possible, all things being equal. These are complex things that we're talking about here. It's not just that there's any silver bullet approach. I think that we shouldn't underestimate the role that education can play in kind of shared nationhood, if you like, and shared understandings of things. So do I think that there should be New Zealand texts, for example, included in our English canon? Yes, absolutely. But I think that those are up to teachers to decide within the context of their school, within a national kind of framework, if that makes sense.
Anyone else got something to add, Marianne?
Some of the research from the 1970s that Michael F.D. Young did, you guys know a lot more about, he looked at the curriculum for working class students in England with the idea that the reason they weren't excelling was because it was a foreign curriculum imposed on them. And they did a very clever thing in that they redesigned a curriculum and then tested it on a small group of students before they actually rolled anything out nationwide. And they found that those students didn't actually do any better on the localized curriculum. And what he's become a proponent for is an understanding that there is some powerful knowledge, and that what is truly equitable is to give all students equal access to that powerful knowledge. And so there are some areas where this or that, whatever, but when it comes especially to mathematics and sciences, things have to be scaffolded. And if a student misses a rung, it's going to have bad effects. So figuring out what those essential rungs are, codifying them, and then letting people improvise is obviously what works best, and that's not what's happening now.
Can I add, I'll just add a single thing to that.
Put a bow on it for us, Steph.
Okay, I'll try. I found this when I came across it. I found it a really helpful way of sort of organizing my thinking. David Geary in the, I want to say 1970s, I'm pretty sure it was the 70s, came up with this distinction, which is based in cognitive science. Primary knowledge is the kind of knowledge that you're going to acquire just by it being around you. So oral language is a form of biologically primary knowledge, where something like reading, as Melissa said earlier, doesn't just happen when you're around it. It's something that you actively have to build cognitively. So biologically secondary knowledge is the kind of knowledge that we should be including in our curriculum. Biologically primary knowledge, less so. Maybe not entirely, but less so.
And that's why I'm a big fan of handwriting, because actually writing something down connects an idea to my body, and we are creatures of body, mind, and soul, and I think we need to address that. Look, it's been a provocative, intriguing, and I hope helpful evening. Thank you very much for being part of this. One of a somewhat plaintive text says, can education ever be free of ideology? Aren't you guys pursuing ideology tonight? I think we need to have all ideologies exist everywhere, but I think if we can base our decisions on evidence and the evidence that's not a study from America of 100 students, then we'll start to be moving in the right direction. So I want to thank our panel, Steph, Melissa, and Marianne. Will you put your hands together for them, please?
Thanks for listening to the Maxim Institute podcast. If you'd like to hear more from us and keep up with the rest of our research and analysis of politics and policy in New Zealand, you can sign up on the homepage of our website to get our monthly forum email and invitations to future Maxim Institute events. You can search and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. From the team at Maxim, mā te wā, goodbye for now.